This is the Talk Theater in Chicago interview podcast for October 26th. I'm your host this week, Ann Nicholson Weber. And my guest today is Michael Montenegro, who is the artistic director of a new puppet-based theater company called Theater Zarco, whose premiere production is running currently at the Noyes Center in Evanston. It's a double header. The Sublime Beauty of Hands is part one, and Clown Cantos is part two. And the production has just extended to November, what, Michael?
15th.
November 15th. So there's still time to see it. Well, what is it? This is a maybe too broad a question, but you're a sculptor on the one hand and a theater artist on the other. So I suppose puppet making is a pretty obvious marriage of those two. Is that why you do it?
I suppose I'm interested in theater, period. In the way that a musician is interested in music, and the puppet is a tool and brings something very special to the theater, in my mind, that an actor can't quite accomplish. A puppet is a very limited thing compared to a human actor, but at the same time, it brings some strange purity. And a strange power that is extremely primitive that I don't think an actor can quite manage to reach, although I think actors attempt it, even unconsciously. Because what you're trying to do on stage is create a world, a poetic world, that is a metaphor for real life. And because you're a human being, it's not quite possible to become a metaphor yourself.
Right.
I mean, King Lear is still an actor that eats a McDonald's beforehand and goes out the back door afterwards and becomes somebody's husband or boyfriend or whatever, but a puppet doesn't. You hang the King Lear puppet in the closet and it's still King Lear. And I mean, there's something that the audience senses by watching that puppet. Not that a King Lear puppet is better than an actor, King Lear, by any means. But the puppet does bring that strange purity that is somewhat primitive. And I say primitive because there's something a little spooky about mannequins and masks and dummies and puppets. And children are slightly frightened of these things, and rightfully so. They sense that there is something there that is uncanny. And I think the puppet person, the puppet artist, can tap into that mysterious force that I think is real.
You've said to me in the past that you think it can be problematic to put puppets into theater that is primarily human actors. And why is that? It seems like it must be related to what you were just talking about.
Yeah, because in my mind, or in my artistic assessment of things, I guess, I see them as two different worlds. And just like, I think, like many things, 2 + 2 = 4, in the case of puppet theater, the puppet world and the human world can cancel each other out. But if done correctly, just like any formula, 2 + 2 = 16. I mean, that, but it's a delicate formula. In the same way that collage, painters experiment with putting photographs onto the painted surface of a painting, and that can be very jarring, and the artist can use that very effectively. But if the artist doesn't know what they're doing, that clash of worlds can destroy,
undermines each of them.
Well,
I feel like the issues you're talking about are brought into play very distinctly in the first piece of the program, the Sublime Beauty of Hands. Which maybe you could quickly describe what the piece is.
Yeah, and let me go back just one second. I just want to add something to what we were saying before that I think is illuminating. The old art of the ventriloquist dummy, in my mind, is a direct experimentation with the combining of a puppet and a human being. And I think any person who gets up on stage to do ventriloquism is demonstrating the power of combining those two worlds. And I think part of the delight of the audience is watching the clash and interaction between those two disparate worlds.
Right, right. Know? Yeah, and that would also lead to a couple of the other pieces in the second half of your program,
yeah,
which at least in some ways play off the ventriloquist,
yeah,
dummy relationship. But let's, yeah, let's go back to Sublime, okay, Beauty and then follow up on,
yeah,
that. So probably you could summarize better than I can what, just very briefly for, mm-hmm, the listening audience, what that piece is.
Well, Sublime Beauty of Hands is a piece that I'm very reluctant to describe because, like so many people say, it's almost a cliche, if I can say it, why paint it? Mm-hmm. But it has to do with creativity and its use, and it's a celebration of creativity and at the same time creativity, the misuse of creativity and the divergence, the making of the choice as to what to use your creativity for. Creativity is a neutral thing. It just means inventiveness. It means using your imagination, mm-hmm, and hard work and to manifest something that doesn't exist. So the piece has to do with that, and also it has to do with the loss of something irreplaceable, in this case, hands, and the hubris involved with the attempt to replace something that's irreplaceable. And of course, it also is to me symbolic of the irreplaceableness of a human being.
Mm-hmm.
That there's so much in the modern world now that gives one the feeling that people don't consider the irreplaceability of another human being. And so decisions are made in callous ways or flippant ways.
Mm-hmm. I sense that you're skittish about talking in too much detail about the piece, but I'm going to kind of push you,
sure,
anyway,
yeah,
because I think that people who haven't seen it would be intrigued. And people who have seen it might, in retrospect, learn something about it by hearing you talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I, you know, what I saw on a kind of narrative level was a story about people who make mines or bombs or something,
mm-hmm,
and use their creativity in that way in order to make money, and then those subsequently take off, you know, an explosion takes off the hands of a child, is,
mm-hmm,
what I saw. But again, it's not an explicit,
yeah,
it is a dream world, it's very evocative, but,
yeah,
and then the rest of the piece, well, not the whole piece, puts in contradistinction the hands of the actors, which we do see, and that's the only part of their bodies that we see. The rest of them is masked in one way or another. And various mechanical contrivances that, at least again, at the storyline, we kind of see people trying to figure out ways to replace her hands with machines.
Mm-hmm.
So is that a fair summary of just at a very basic, mm-hmm, boiled down and who cares level?
Yes, yes, it is. It is. And I think the excitement on my part, and hopefully on the part of an audience, is the visual poetic imagery that blossoms from that dark idea.
Right.
And just like in a dream, you can have a nightmare. You can have a very disturbing dream full of incredibly beautiful imagery.
Mm-hmm.
And
right,
in a way that says something about life in general, where, you know, Yeats uses the phrase that I love. He says, the terrifying beauty of life. And I think anything that is incredibly beautiful is on the edge of being terrifying. And, you know, mm-hmm, when the first atomic bomb was exploded, the comment was made by the man that headed the Manhattan Project. It was terrifyingly beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, life in general has a terrifying beauty to it when it's faced head on. Mm-hmm. And we normally just try to escape the terrifying part of it, and mm-hmm. we miss the beauty of it too. So, mm-hmm.
Well, what was one of the things that was interesting to me about the aesthetic of that piece? It does. I mean, it certainly succeeds so well in. It did for me in seeing hands, mm-hmm. just in a way that I wouldn't or have thought to for years or ever. You know, mm-hmm. by creating first of all by masking out all the rest of the human body, so we're really looking at them, and then putting them into this world of the puppet, where everything is essentially a machine. But what I wanted to say about it is, in a way, it's for a puppet maker to tell a story about how inadequate any mechanical representation or substitution for the human body is ironic, or is, you know, you're saying part of what the piece says is we can't replace a body, we can't replace a hand, and yet your whole project as a puppet maker in a way is to use a machine to replace an actor. So I just wonder if you have any response to that. To me, it added a level.
Well, no, that's beautifully put. I think that any artist is in awe of the beauty of the things that he or she is surrounded by, mm-hmm. The human being one of them, and there is, I think, always the despair at not being able to come anywhere near the extraordinariness of what the person, I hesitate to say sees, but because it's more than seeing. I mean, when you're doing a portrait of somebody, it's, you're not seeing them, you're feeling them. You're feeling their presence, and that's what you wish you could encapture, and of course you can't. Mm-hmm. And there is the frustration. So, yeah.
The things we can't make.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit, too, about the second half, which is a very, 180 degrees turn in terms of the temperament of it. So the Clown Cantos, which is a compilation of short pieces, unlike mm-hmm. Sublime Beauty, which is one. And there are three solo pieces that you do as part of that. And this is where I want to go back to the idea of the ventriloquist and the dummy, because actually in all three of those, you, the puppet manipulator, puppeteer, are, well, particularly in two, you're very much an actor mm-hmm. in the scene. And I wanted to ask you, what is it that makes it work when you have the puppet world and the human world interacting? Because you've said it's very delicate. Can you at all describe why it works in some cases, and I would say in those pieces?
I don't know. I mean, I'll tell you what I think it is. It's re-entering the world of the child or the child's psychology, which is an expansive psychology compared to an adult psychology. And I say that because a child can sit in a room and play with sticks and be as absorbed as Shakespeare mm-hmm. when he was writing his plays. And as an adult, that's very hard to recapture. So I think my pleasure in doing Calvin or doing the puppet that comes out of the bag is trying to recapture that experience of surprising myself, I think.
Just to talk very quickly about the technique of Calvin in particular, both pieces essentially require you to split your body,
mm-hmm.
which is not true of all puppet manipulation, I guess, for not a marionette, for instance. It's an actor's skill, really, to be mm-hmm. able to mm-hmm. make one part of your body belong to this other person. Mm-hmm. How do you rehearse that? How do you do it?
Well, I'm not a very disciplined rehearser of these things. In fact, both of those pieces I came up with in very crude version, and I performed them right away. And I perfected them 5 minutes before the performance out of terror.
It's like, and this goes back a number of years that you've been doing those two pieces.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. And somehow I would not be even interested enough in doing it until an hour before the performance, when the terror would set in and I'd realize I've got to get up and make people laugh with this, otherwise I'm going to bomb. And so with that terror, that anxiety, I was able to use in a creative way to force myself to come up with things that would work, and I would try them on stage. And then I developed the skill of improvising in front of an audience. That's much easier if you're solo. You know, when you're working with other people, it's hard. But so a lot of the inventions, the things in the piece came from actual performances on the spot. I'm still, in fact, when you saw it, I was doing things last night with Calvin, which is the doppelganger or whatever, double person. I was doing things for the first time last night. I was trying to solve certain problems that I've had all along, and I mean, those are the performances that I really appreciate and enjoy, because you put a lot of work into something, and suddenly something is really funny. I mean, it's a great kick to make people laugh, and it becomes a tremendous motivation, and that too is mysterious. I mean, what is that all about? But there was a woman that talked to me last night that said she had tears in her eyes. She was laughing so hard during
Calvin,
I don't know why that's a satisfying thing. I mean, things are funny to me, and to be able to manifest those things that are funny to other people, I don't know, laughing is a great release. And I often feel like, man, I just wish I could make people laugh. Things are so horrible, you know. It would be nice to go to a refugee camp and make everybody laugh for a minute. And I mean, what else is there, you know?
People certainly were laughing at the theater last night. I know what we should go back to. You've just taken this big step of creating a theater company, and you have a permanent space. And what are your hopes for that? What was the impulse?
Making a living with art, I think. And coupled with that is the experience of sharing an artistic vision with a wider audience, because there's a great return when you do that. You get response from people, and you get it opens up a dialogue of ideas if you're lucky, and I think to work with a group allows me to do pieces that I'm not a part of, that I'm not in. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm very interested in sitting out and directing. I have other pieces I'd really like to mount, and they're not solo things. So that's really true.
Mm-hmm. And I think at one point you talked about wanting to have some kind of a festival invite writing from outside for puppets.
Yes.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I suppose launching into this, obviously you're hit with reality, with what it really means to run something like this. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little more cautious about talking up future projects, but I do have hopes that we can launch a festival of puppet pieces, or pieces written specifically for puppet theater by interested playwrights or interested poets. And the question would be, what might distinguish a puppet play from a human play, and how might that invite a different type of writing? Mm-hmm. It's simply a question, because I don't know if there is an answer to that. But I imagine it to be a fertile experiment.
Yeah. Well, maybe can we explore just a little bit about your inklings about what makes effective writing for puppet actors?
Well, I put it out as a question, because I have to admit I'm not really sure. I think that that because a puppet is much more limited than a human actor, the words have to be spare, and they also have to be somehow different from the words that come out of a human actor's mouth. A puppet, by nature, is a distortion, an exaggeration, and so somehow I think the language, the words, the music that comes out of the puppet has to be somewhat distorted, exaggerated, distilled. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of three minute puppet plays, which is probably a good length for a puppet play to start out.
How long does it take, for instance, how long did it take you just to make the puppets for Sublime Beauty of Hands?
Well, they're not puppets in the conventional sense. So they are objects, mechanical objects and masks and photographs. And I have to use the term loosely, puppets loosely in that piece. But nothing of mine, nothing that I use ever is anything that took a really long time to make. I don't labor over these things. In fact, I was always hungry to find a method of building that would allow me to quickly disassemble things and reassemble them in a way that they were more effective. Because a puppet has to move beautifully. It can't only look good. It has to move. And so if you build something and you spend hours and hours and hours making this puppet look extraordinary, and you suddenly discover it can't move, you're very reluctant to take it apart and rework it. Mm-hmm. So I find these quick ways so that I can discover the problems
quickly in the process. Yeah. I would think though that there in the Sublime Beauty of Hands, there's one prosthesis, I guess you could say, wire hand that looked like it would have been a lot of work to create. No.
No, that really didn't take me very long to make at all.
Because it's so articulated and so.
Yeah, but it's. I mean, I'm glad it looks like. It
Get lots of credit for that.
Yeah. But like my father was a really great painter, and he always said, you know, when people show him work, he was a teacher also, and people would say, "Here, look at what do you think of my painting?" And If my father didn't care for it too much, he wouldn't say very much, and they'd say, "But it took me forever to paint this thing." Mm. And my father would always kind of mumble, "Well, you know, that doesn't matter."
Right, who cares?
Yeah, who cares? Right. Beautiful things can be done very quickly, and sometimes they're just based on a lot of work from the past that took forever.
Right.
And suddenly you do something very quickly.
Pay off from all that investment.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Theater Zarco, I think, represents some of that, a number of decades thinking about puppet theater. Now there's a place you can go see it. So thanks very much for joining me to talk about it.
Thank you very much, Anne. Wonderful questions.